My name is Gerald Solomon, and I'm the Executive Director of the Henry and Susan Samueli Foundation in Southern California. And a major part of our funding is within this area in this field. I'm going to dispense with the bios because these people, one, as you hear them, you'll see how competent and well-known they are, and two, you can read, so you can go ahead into the book and read about their bios. So let me start and ask a little bit about who the audience is so that the speakers get a sense of who's in the room. How many people here fund in the integrative medicine field, if you could raise your hands? Well, actually a couple. That's great to see. So let me ask it a different way. How many people take nutritional supplementations? How many people have ever been to a chiropractor? How many people have ever used acupuncture? How many people pray? Well, all of those modalities are all parts of what we call integrative medicine. You'll hear different aspects about that from the speakers. And what we're going to do is something a little bit different here today. We're going to start with a couple of questions and answers amongst the panelists. Then they're each going to do a presentation on a topic that's unique to their work in what they're doing. And then we'll come back again to Q&A to the audience and to all of you so we can have an interchange and conversation. So I'm going to take a seat for a minute, and I'm going to first thank the panelists for being here and flying in to be able to participate. And I'm going to start with a general question that is often discussed within the field, and that is, with the onset of ACA and its potential adoption over the next few years, and the whole discussion around whole patient and patient-centered care, what do you respectively see as the role of integrative medicine? And in particular, what are you and your organizations doing to foster that relationship between integrative medicine and the onset and adoption of the Affordable Care Act? So Dan, if you can kind of start with that.
Sure, it's an important thing to think about. First, I'd like to just express what a pleasure and privilege it is to be here with all of you, my distinguished co-panelists, and many thanks to Gerald for all of his work in organizing this, also John Jackson from the Coors Foundation behind the scenes, and the terrific supportive staff, Lindsay, Rachel, everybody, thank you. So integrative medicine is really about whole patient care, and so the timing is perfect for integrative medicine to take a leading role in that. When we think about the major illnesses that confront us when we get into those middle decades of life, everything from diabetes to cancer, there's been a dramatic change in the last couple of decades about what are really the causative factors. Now, genes are important, and we know a lot about genes, not nearly as much as we need to know. But what a lot of people are surprised to know is that up to 75% of expression of those genes depends upon lifestyle variables, such as diet and nutrition, stress levels, which we'll talk about, and other environmental factors, activity level, and addressing the whole person, spirituality, whether or not people have connection to that which is meaningful to a person, all of those variables, biological, social, spiritual, are all in a dynamic interplay affecting health and wellness, and indeed, even more important considerations than the genes themselves, because genes can express themselves in different ways. There's our constitutional genes, which don't change anything. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow morning 5'2". However, the old thinking that if my father had high blood pressure and his father had high blood pressure, I must have high blood pressure. As a society, we're not all born in the United States with a Lipitor deficiency gene, and therefore later in life must all take it. What we're born with is a set of genes that we have to take more personal responsibility for, and some of that responsibility also falls on the medical community to continue to educate people, which hasn't been as successful as we would like. The CDC for over a decade now has had guidelines, how many vegetables and fruits should people be eating, what should activity level be. But as a nation, we fail miserably. We spend more on healthcare dollars than any other country in the world, by far. Are we number one in health status? Where are we? Are we number two? Who thinks we're top 10? Top 20? Top 30? We're 37th in the world. Is it because we're born with a worse set of genes than the other countries of the world? Or is it because we're doing something differently that we need to be paying attention to? Integrative medicine is rooted in the principles of conventional medicine. It's not alternative medicine by any means. It's embracing the conventional medical model and then adding to it, enhancing it with things that make sense, that are proven, from lifestyle interventions to judicious use of complementary therapies that have some promising basis in evidence. And part of our job in integrative medicine is also to test those things that have promise. So now's the time for integrative medicine, and I think that everything that we see going on around us supports that.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Wayne, if you can respond as well, please.
Thank you, I will. And thank you for inviting us and for having this session. So in ACA, I'll just add one thing to what Dan said. So to get to that 37th percent, we also pay twice as much as any other country for it. So I think the key issue is that the marginal investment in health care system for producing health is now marginal and it's diminishing, and we can talk about that a little bit later. So even before the Obama administration came in and started the ACA effort in healthcare movement, we had put together a policy group to really look at how would you create a wellness industry, how would you create a wellness culture that facilitated human flourishing, health promotion within the nation. We wrote a policy piece called the Wellness Initiative for the Nation, testified a couple times as they were going through the ACA process, and got inserted into that process, as everybody else did, their favorite little component. I think there's two major problems with ACA is that it's a whole bunch of special instruments dumped into a blender and mixed up, and there's some good stuff in there and there's some bad stuff in there. I think that the two major things that emerged out of that was a payment reform to try to cover more people for basic health care, and that's a major effort. Yet, as we've indicated, and as Daniel's indicated, if we simply cover more people with the same system we have right now, it's not going to make them healthy. Only about 10 to 20% of the health markers, the health aspects, the health metrics in the country are actually influenced by health care. Most of them are influenced outside of our health care system, which is not a health care system. It is a disease management system. It is a disease treatment system. And when you need disease treatment, especially for acute infectious traumatic disease, it is fantastic. Everybody wants it. It's one of the reasons why we no longer have the acute, we no longer die when we're 5 years old as they do in developing countries from acute infectious diseases, and why we have an aging population. But it doesn't address health. And so part of what we did out of the Wellness Initiative for the Nation was then write our own little section of ACA that resulted in the National Prevention Health Promotion Council. Now, the difference between this and the rest of the ACA is that it was not primarily focused on the healthcare system. It was 17 different agencies, including finance, including education, including transportation, including agriculture, all looking at what is their contribution to the enhancement of health or in creating obstacles to the enhancement of health in the nation. And so that is in there. It's a little known part of the act, but we feel that eventually it'll provide some of the next wave in those areas. Now, integrative practices, complementary practices, because of their philosophy and their orientation around health promotion and health enhancement, were bundled into that effort. And so they've become part of that effort. But if you look back and say, well, what's the real goal of a healthcare system? What should it be doing if it is producing health? Then we need to focus now on the early determinants of those, the causes and not the end states. Throwing lots of money at the end when you need it costs a lot. If you need it, you need it. If you need your bypass, then you need to get your bypass to save your life. But you could have prevented, or you could reduce the likelihood of having a problem if you paid attention to those underlying determinants. And that's the area that health promotion and to some extent integrative practices contribute to.
Right. Thanks, Wayne. Christina, your thoughts?
And thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed being on this panel and for all of you coming. So just to frame my answer, I in addition to my academic work, I am an active clinician. I'm a physician. I see internal medicine patients, geriatric patients, palliative care patients. And so I'm actually in the field, you know, doing this and feeling a little bit of hesitance about healthcare moving forward. And for this reason, with regard to spirituality. So spirituality is very broadly defined as how people find meaning and purpose. And from the number of hands that were raised, it seems that many of you have some spiritual practices that may be important to you. But it moves beyond the practices. It really moves to the fact that all of us, whether we're religious or not, are spiritual beings. All of us seek meaning and purpose. All of us, when given a bad diagnosis or facing stress, start asking questions about our lives, and what may have given us meaning may not give us meaning in the face of breast cancer, let's say, or prostate cancer. If we enter into a system, we all of us also want relationships, and that is a key focus of the spirituality and health movement, is how can we acknowledge that the relationships with our physicians, with our patients, are critical and are important. And while I agree that we need to reform our health system and we need to improve access, I fear that some of the trends going forward will and have already devalued the relationship between the healthcare professional and the patient. And what that has done, and I see some of you shaking your heads, maybe from personal experience or not, what that has done is it's actually worsened our healthcare outcomes. As you know, just this morning I was on the phone, a patient was admitted to the hospital. They're changing all her medications. Fortunately, they asked me and called me if it was okay, because I know that's not going to work for her, because I know that patient. I've treated her for 12 years. We need to really understand that in all of this, and one of the reasons I got interested in spirituality and health was from seeing, at that time called complementary and alternative practitioners, who valued what's really important to the physician, but also valued the importance of really listening to patients, to really listening to what's important to their lives, and to integrate and to understand that you can actually come up with better diagnoses and better treatment plans if you have that holistic kind of focus. So in addition to what my colleague said, I definitely think we have to have a whole health focus, but I think we really have to advocate for the relationship. So what we at Jewish are doing is we are hosting a conference at the end of November in policy. There's a flyer there called Making Healthcare Whole, a book that was developed from a national consensus process on integration of spirituality into healthcare as part of regular healthcare. That came to the attention of Dan Smith, who was the head of the Senate Health Committee, and he said, these are principles that need to be heard. These are principles that are not currently integrated into this plan. And so our work is to try to knock on the doors of Washington, D.C. and other health policy organizations to say, you know, it's about relationships. It's really important. Let's value that. It's about holistic care.
Thank you, Christina. So let's drill down to a topic we're all too aware of, unfortunately. That's called stress. Stress kind of permeates our life in some fashion, in some way, probably on a daily basis. We all know that there's a correlation between stress and chronic diseases. Can you each share a little bit about the work that you're doing around stress reduction in your work, your organization, and how to affect and address the challenges with that? You can start again with Dan.
Right. So my clinical and research focus is working with cancer patients to improve survivorship, to improve outcomes, quality of life, and the cancer experience. And stress is a very important variable in that work. But let's take a step back. What is stress, and is all stress bad? We need to have stress to some degree. We need acute stress. If you're in the jungle and see a lion in the distance, you want that stress response to kick in so that you go into fight or flight mode and hopefully don't go the direction of fight and fly and climb up a tree quickly or something like that. Find safety, shelter. That mobilization is important. The problem is that in our society and daily life, the lion in the jungle is replaced by a deadline. Your kid is sick, a family death, and they mount and they mount and they become continuous, or worse yet, a cancer diagnosis. What What does this mean? What does this mean for my family? What does this mean for my children? All of those things then become a compounding stressor to the stresses of everyday life. This has an impact on the way people feel, function, their quality of life, and actually their cancer outcomes. And I sit on a study section for the National Institutes of Health, and I've been watching the preclinical data that's been published in the last 2 to 3 years showing that tumors grow with stress chemicals and stress hormones. And so stress is an important variable. Here's a problem, though. Despite knowing that, many people and many distressed patient subgroups, including cancer patients, don't utilize any type of stress reduction services, even when they're available, even when they're offered to the person. And oftentimes they're not. And oftentimes they're not available. But even when they are, uptake is relatively low. So part of our job is to develop innovative stress reduction programs and services for people that they'll feel more inclined to utilize, that won't feel stigmatizing. And that's where integrative medicine really has a role. In my slides, I'll show you one of the programs we developed with philanthropic support and then got a large NIH grant. It was very successful. We're still publishing on the outcomes of that intervention. But integrative medicine has the potential to provide the types of services that will help people cope with a stressful challenge like cancer and improve overall quality of life. It's what we do a lot of at our center, and I know that many other centers around the country are focusing on the same.
Wayne?
Okay. Thank you. I'm glad, Dan, that you mentioned the response to stress as being the key factor. I'll illustrate or answer your question by illustrating some of the work we do with the military, a group that has been under a little bit of stress in the last 10 years. So I was in the military for 24 years before I left the government and ran the organization we do now. And we continue to see patients who've been deployed. I work at Walter Reed now one day a week and see patients up there. We do a lot of research in the area of PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and chronic pain in that population. They have been psychologically, socially, physically bombarded for the last 10 years with multiple deployments, injuries, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress syndrome. So the emergence out of that is stress management and coping skills. The term that's used is resilience. How do you develop the ability to respond to stress in a way in which you can restore, recover, reintegrate, and flourish as opposed to break down in those areas? We're constantly, all of us, bombarded by stressors. Most of us are not aware of how we're coping with them. Most of us are not aware of the wear and tear that it's having on us because they're invisible. So I'll give you an example of one of those studies that was just published. It was a randomized controlled trial of a relaxation technique involving two types of approaches in an attempt to teach, in this case, Marines, done at Camp Pendleton in partnership with the Scripps Institute, Scripps Hospital, in which Marines who had post-traumatic stress syndrome were taught how to deeply relax. There were two techniques that were used that come out of integrative complementary practices. One is a common technique used by nurses around the country who get certified in something called healing touch. And this, anybody know? Who knows about healing touch? Several folks. And so it's a standardized approach that involves centering. It involves getting yourself in a calm place, right, with your heart rate variability properly regulated, etc. And then the other person begins to feel that. You all know this. You walk into a room and some people just calm you down, right? Okay. So it's teaching nurses how to calm a person down and let the other person experience that sense of a healing presence. They paired this with an imagery tape. So they were doing healing touch with the post-traumatic Marines, and they had them listen to an imagery tape, which is something they could take home then and do for themselves. They paired it so that they would get a deep experience when they listened to the tape of deep relaxation. So teaching them these coping mechanisms. Then they took that home. They only did it six times, okay? Six times diagnosed PTSD, and they saw a huge drop in PTSD, a huge increase in quality of life after the end of 2 months. In fact, almost half of the folks no longer met the criteria for PTSD in these areas simply by inducing this deep relaxation and then teaching them skills through the imagery tape to be able to do it on their own at home. So this is an empowering approach, much different than sort of a disempowering approach in which if you have PTSD and you go in and they say, well, I'm going to have to treat you, I'm going to have to give you a medication, or you're going to depend on me to help manage your stress, which is what we tend to do in the medical system now. So I think this is an example that if it were widely distributed, verified and validated in other sites, could have a tremendous benefit for our service members and allow them to get back to daily function that then could allow them to get to school, to get to work, and this type of thing.
Christina?
Oh, thank you, Wayne. I think that the comments you just made are so critical about the notion of healing versus cure, and healing really is in the hands of the, you know, of ourselves or the people, not the physicians, nurses, and others. And to empower people, I think, is critical. Some of the work we're doing, certainly with spirituality, there's been a lot of data that shows that spirituality can help people mitigate the negative effects of stress that you've just heard about. In our work at GWISH, we're working with healthcare professionals in a number of different ways. We are teaching them ways to be more present. Medical students are learning to be more present to their patients through two different kinds of ways. One is to offer mindfulness and relaxation response training, but also in programs called the reflection rounds, which is a way to help students get in touch with their own responses to their interactions with their patients. So typically our education courses are geared around how can you learn to communicate better with your patients. If you had said this, would that have had a better response? So it's always focused around the patient. What we're finding out is that we're not doing very much to enhance the vocational training or formation of our students. And so reflection rounds is really about the student. What does it mean to be called to walk with someone that's suffering? How have I been affected? How did it affect me emotionally, spiritually? And in those conversations, we raise the themes around spirituality, meaning around resiliency. How do you respond to stress? What do you do about that? That it's okay actually to tell your colleagues, I'm a little stressed, I need help right now. That's some of the work we're doing. We also run a retreat now. This is going to be our eighth year in Assisi, Italy, for healthcare professionals who come for what's called the art of presence. And they start with, who am I as a person? What is my call? What is my sense of vocation? And they move through a week of training around resiliency, learning what compassion and presence is, what kind of practices, particularly spiritual practices, they might use in their own professional lives. And we then follow our colleagues that have been there and have found that a lot of these interventions have helped them manage their stress much more. And then finally, we've been asked by the president of our university to develop a wellness initiative, again, based on the biopsychosocial spiritual. And as our HR person said, we have to add financial, so it's the biopsychosocial spiritual financial model of wellness. And this will be a required program for all employees, because of the university's observation that, again, stress causes absentee days, sick days, not putting in their full effort at work, not finding meaning out of their work, and, again, the spiritual basis around that of how people can work better.
Great, thank you. That's a good segue into Dan's presentation. Dan's going to go ahead. If you can hit the button and give Dan the... He's going to do a presentation on some of his work around stress and stress management.
This one right here, right? Great.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
I think this would be a good place to stand. I'm not in anybody's way, am I? Good.
Go ahead.
Okay. Great. So I'm at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. We have an integrative medicine center called the Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine that was founded in 1998. And it was a very small operation. It's become and sort of a black sheep of the university. What is this thing that you're doing? But at the lead, what has always been an advantage for us is at the leadership level of the institution, there was an understanding that this could be an important thing. And over time, it has become that. So we were this little satellite off-campus clinic back in the late 90s. We now have maybe the nicest real estate on campus at Jefferson. We have over 10,000 feet of clinical space. We have multiple clinical trials going on. We have flourishing programs. We have a wellness facility attached to us where we run our group wellness programs, everything from stress reduction to smoking cessation and personalized fitness training. We see very sick people. We see executive health physicals. It's the gamut, and we're about to expand out into the Philadelphia suburbs, where we're building a satellite location almost as big as our downtown location. It's because there's a need for what we're doing, and as my co-panelist has said, stress, lifestyle, diet and nutrition, all of those things need to be integrated into the medical plan, and people want physicians who understand that, who can help them with that, and they want to go for their medical care to a place that then has the programs that can support those things. It's one thing to be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and say, and be told, you know, you might be able to help this with your diet, so watch your diet, and here's a prescription. And it's not the fault of the primary care physicians. As Wayne said, you know, the model is set up for disease and also acutely dealing with them. They're putting out fires. They have to see 6-7 people an hour. So they do the intervention they need to. They move on to the next person. We're proposing a different model, and it's one that has its challenges and on all kinds of levels, from political to patient access. But we know that it works, and I want to show you a little bit of the data about that. So as we said before, our genes are one thing, but how those genes express themselves, what you look like today, who you are, how you function, how you feel, how you think, your genes are a component, but the environment that those genes are bathed in, from everything you do to everything you think, has some role in the expression of those genes. Consider it your genes like keys on a keyboard. So the keys themselves are important. There's a difference between a Steinway grand piano and my grandmother's upright piano. So there's a difference. However, who's playing is the difference too, because if I sit down at the Steinway, or we bring Horowitz back from the dead and put him at my grandmother's upright piano, you're going to get two very different songs, and you can still get a beautiful song out of that upright piano. And I think that that's an important message that we try to convey. And this slide I kind of already said. So I want to move into stress for just a moment, because the chronic stressors in life are very perceptual. We have stress, but we also need a way to navigate stress, to cope with stress. And as I mentioned, my focus is cancer patients and working with cancer patients. And we know that whether or not it's a cancer patient, there are ramifications to stress when it's chronic, when there aren't ways of dealing with it. And beyond those ramifications, there's downstream effectors in terms of immune variables, increasing inflammation in the system, which is the root of all evil for virtually every illness we know of. We developed a program for, it has George Washington University somehow on there, but this was our program at Jefferson. although I think George Washington University is a wonderful place, and I know you have some mindfulness programs. Not sure what happened to the slides here. But it was an 8-week program that has its core in mindfulness meditation, and it must have been when we added your slides at the end. So I think, Wayne, you're going to be George Washington University as well when your slides come up. But for cancer patients, we wanted there to be an expressive component. So we added some art therapy tasks that were paired to the meditation exercises. It allowed for a multi-dimensional processing of the stress. However, something like that, you can't just go to the National Institutes of Health without pilot data. without any kind of initial testing of a program, there'll be a nice idea next. It's a very competitive world out there. We needed philanthropic support to do the initial study. We got it, and we did a large-scale study then that the NIH did fund. And the results of that study, the first phase of the results, were looking at functional MRI changes in the brain. This paper just was accepted for publication last week, so you'll be the first to see it, some of this data. But we had a control group that got equal time and attention, and it was one of the standard breast cancer support educational programs versus our program. And I don't have time because I keep getting warnings that I only have a couple minutes left. So basically, the brain changed, not only in terms of emotional processing pre to post intervention as compared to the intervention group, the control group, but when you gave people a stressful task, they were less stressed pre to post intervention as compared to the control group. This is huge because we know what the ramifications are. Another big study, it's the last one that I'll focus on, is that there was all this debate in the literature about vitamin C. So as an integrative academic center, we said, okay, we'll lead the charge on this because the NIH did the preclinical studies that said, you know, maybe Pauling wasn't wrong, but we need to look at the issue again. But the NIH didn't want to look at the issue again. It took a foundation that said, there's enough convincing data to look at the issue again. What do you want to do? We put together a clinical trial with pancreatic cancer patients. We just published this earlier this year, and essentially showed that while this isn't definitive, there's something very promising about revisiting the vitamin C issue. Now, it has to be intravenous. It has to be given like a drug in the clinic. It's not oral. You can take all the oral you want. This has to be infused. But the point is, without philanthropic support from a major foundation to say, go ahead and do the phase one trial, we wouldn't be doing the phase one trial as we are. Look at everybody's primary tumor went down. Now, I don't know what that means in terms of long-term outcomes and things like that, if they'll live longer, but we know something is happening with the tumor cell biology. We wouldn't know that if there wasn't the support from philanthropists like yourselves. We have some other studies that we're just starting. Again, philanthropic support. The Coors Foundation is funding this first one with N-acetylcysteine. John Jackson is right there. Effects on breast cancer biology. A group at Jefferson of basic scientists have shown, now this is an antioxidant. At high doses, it's a drug that protects the liver when you have a Tylenol overdose. So we do a combination of infusions and oral. You can buy it over the counter. Because in all of the animal and preclinical data that we've done, it improves the tumor cell biology. But the NIH isn't going to fund that unless you've got good, hardcore, basic data. That's where a foundation comes into play to really lead the charge in getting some novel, innovative data. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it requires philanthropists to take a chance, and that has really worked well for us, and we're really pleased to have the partnerships that we have. And another foundation is also helping us to look at immune variable changes as well as fMRI with people who have post-traumatic stress in cancer patients. And we're also looking at calorie restriction and dietary modification, because what we found is the oncologists had it reversed. Calorie restriction during chemotherapy actually improves outcomes. All the animal data shows it. Now there's some human data. We're looking at it in radiation oncology patients. Couldn't do that without philanthropic support. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dan, for doing it so well. Wayne, Dr. Jonas, if you could, please.
I have no slides, so I have no need to mix them up with anybody else's, but I will stand up if you don't mind, just so
sure.
People can see me a little bit better. I'm going to tell a story. How many here have actually funded something in what would be maybe this category of complementary and alternative medicine, whether it's prayer? How many groups here have done that? So a lot. How many of you feel like you funded them prematurely? Oh, really? So how many of them were wildly successful and led on to bigger and better things and had major impact in society? Really? Fantastic. Yes, okay. So So the whole area of where does philanthropy's role and how early do you get in and, you know, where's the sweet spot in that, I think, is it's a complex and difficult thing to address. I'm going to give you an example again from the military because I think it's an example of where there is a sweet spot, because it's a system that is ready to look at some of these areas in terms of system impact. I'm family doc. During my military career, I was stationed in Germany. I had to deal with the German medical emergency transport because we ran a remote clinic, and they did all of our emergency transport. So I went to the local German Medical Society meetings to meet with them, talk about, find out what they did. And they did a lot of stuff I learned in medical school, standard, you know, medication and treatment and management. But they also did a number of other unusual things. And this is way back in the 70s. They had acupuncture for pain regularly. The number one prescription for depression in Germany by physicians was an herb. They used something called homeopathy. I remember a physician brought this little tube of a homeopathic product here. How many are familiar with homeopathy or aware of it? Okay. And I looked at it. I knew nothing about it. He looked at it. He says, oh, I use this for sciatica before I send people for steroid injections or surgery or anything like that. And I said, well, what is in it? What's in it? And he described it to me. And I did my little calculations in my head. And I said, wait a minute. There's nothing in here. And he said, this works. Use it. Okay. Tried it out on some of my patients, and it seemed to work about 80% of the time, actually. So I said, something's going on here. I need to find out about this. Why do they have a bigger medical bag than I have? I have a lot of patients I can't help, and yet they seem to have a lot of things. So he began to do science in there. When I came back from Germany, I was at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, and I decided to go into research because I thought the science is what we need to help sort out the wheat from the chaff in this area. And I still believe that doing good science is essential. And so I'm over in my little lab doing work on homeopathic treatment of infectious epidemics, influenza, and things like that, which is another story. And suddenly the Office of Alternative Medicine at the NIH opens up, and I said, oh, hey, here's a great way to actually do research on these areas. So I asked my military supervisor, can I be detailed over there on a temporary assignment to run the Office of Alternative Medicine, which he said, okay. Little did I know that I was jumping into the fire because it was premature. I had an advisory board at the NIH. On the one hand, one group on the advisory board still used the term quackupuncture at the time. Okay? And on the other group on the advisory board, and they usually sat in two different sides of the room, I thought NCI stood for National Conspiracy Against Cancer Interventions. Okay? In other words, they thought they were suppressing cancer cures that were discoverable out there. Vitamin C was one of the ones they debated extensively in that area. And so there was a lot of controversy in those areas. But we seeded all kinds of things. There was no critical mass. There were no experienced scientists in this area, like you see here, to do that. And so we put a fair amount of money. My first year, I pumped $12 million into a bunch of different studies, different sites. The vast majority of them failed. The vast majority of them failed. And it was those failures that actually taught us how to sort out the wheat from the chaff and actually how to make a path that could have impact in society as a whole in those areas. And so taking the risks, the government is not, and the NIH especially, is not very risk adverse. This was their little opportunity to be a little risk adverse in those areas. They're not nearly as risk adverse, as I'm sure you all can say. You can't get those kinds of risky studies done anymore. But one of those was an attempt to really look at acupuncture for pain. Now, we did a consensus conference back then, and this was 15 years ago, and the consensus conference said, well, gee, it seems like acupuncture works for post-operative pain. So after you've had an operation, there were sufficient randomized placebo-controlled trials to look at that. So here the NIH said works for that. How many of you today can walk in your local neighborhood hospital 15 years or more later and get acupuncture after you've had surgery? Anybody? One. Okay? The problem is not the science for this particular one. The problem is the implementation issue. The problem is getting it into the system. So we've been working with a system that is very interested in doing this. and taking acupuncture and saying, how do we get this in our system? And again, it's the military. Military is hit with chronic pain, multiple chronic pain from injuries, from post-traumatic, from traumatic brain injury in those areas. So we seeded a little study at Malcolm Groh Air Force Base looking at, can you use a simplified ear technique, five little points. In fact, they're not even needles. They're little studs that you press in. You don't have to use even and manipulate needles. Little studs that you press in, 5 points in the ear. Can it treat acute pain? We did it in the emergency room. So people came in, all they needed, you know, they didn't have an organic problem that needed to be treated. They needed pain. They came in primarily for pain medication. And then we offered them acupuncture, ear acupuncture, instead of the pain medication. Pain medication is a backup. 24% after a single hour of the ear acupuncture said, I no longer need any pain medication. 24% for 1 hour. So the military said, aha, this is something we could use. So they began to invest in that area. We did then a number of subsequent studies in those areas showing that it was generalizable. A lot of folks could do this. So they are aggressively trying to figure out, how do we make this a mainstream benefit? How do we train people to actually be able to use this in all areas of care, primary care, et cetera, including post-operative care, which is similar kind of acute pain environment. Now, we talked earlier about the whole issue of this inherent healing capacity and trying to stimulate that. If I learn one thing at NIH about the myriad areas, hundreds, literally hundreds of different modalities in these areas, it is that the core value that comes out of the philosophy of integrative medicine is that we don't need to have a dependency system, that we can, in fact, tap into those inherent healing capacities. And yet our system doesn't do that very much. Arthur Brooks talked about learned helplessness. Well, what happens when you walk into a hospital? You learn helplessness very quickly, right? Your clothes are taken off, you put a robe on, you're laid flat, the authorities stand over you in those areas. We have a dependency-producing system, the exact type of thing that he said we need to get away from. How do we develop a system that taps into that inherent healing capacity in these areas? And so some of the modalities that we were talking about in those areas were an example. So one more study, I'll use the military example, I'll stick with that because that's an example of where there's a sweet spot that is going to kind of benefit these areas. PTSD, I talked about the relaxation studies with PTSD in those areas. We also did at Walter Reed a study of acupuncture in PTSD. You go, well, why acupuncture for PTSD? I thought it was for pain. In fact, acupuncture appears to induce a number of the resistance or resilience or trauma response syndromes across the mind-body. It helps you relax. It improves depression. It improves sleep, which by itself improves depression and well-being and this type of thing, and it improves pain. And so it appears to be salutogenic. It appears to be a process that stimulates the inherent recovery processes. So we tested this out at Walter Reed in a PTSD and chronic pain population, and most of the service members that are coming back have a lot of comorbidities. They don't just have one thing. Okay? They have problems with depression, anxiety, PTSD, sleep problems, pain problems, fatigue and energy problems. They have what are called in medical lingo comorbidities. We wanted to know, does acupuncture affect those? So we took a population like this and gave them 8 treatments of a simplified form of acupuncture. It wasn't as simple as the ear one, but it was like 9 points, 8 treatments over 3 months. Measured the PTSD scores, the pain scores, the cognitive function, etc. All of them improved. Those who had PTSD, 56% of them didn't have it after 1 month of acupuncture treatment. At the end of that month, we stopped. No more treatments. But we followed them out for a total of 3 months, and we said, okay, what is happening? Is it going to be a relapse? If you had, in fact, taken them off their drug therapies, you would have had a relapse and a rebound, likely. And so we wanted to see that. And so we waited with no treatments for 3 months, and they continued to improve. So it induced some type of shift in their healing capacity, their internal physiology, their stress issues, their coping issues, that maintained improved cognitive function, better sleep, lower anxiety and depression rates in those areas. That is a salutogenic intervention. It's much different than an intervention that's trying to control the symptoms. Okay? It's a deep therapeutic intervention in those areas. That study was seeded by a philanthropic organization, the Samueli's actually, that allowed us to do that study. And now the military is saying, we got to pick this up. We got to put it in. That's what I mean by system impact in those areas. And so that's the kind of sweet spots that I think if you all could find and seed in those areas, you'll be able to make a real transformative change in our systems. Thank you.
Okay, so I guess we'll just keep up. There we go. Okay, great. And we would be honored to have you at GW, so thank you, both of you, for that matter. So imagine that you go to your doctor's office or a doctor's office, and your doctor tells you, you know, I'm sorry, but the biopsy is positive, you have cancer. The doctor never takes his or her eyes off the computer screen or keeps rustling through the papers. You are wondering, what does positive mean? Does it mean I'm going to die? What does it mean? You're asking those questions, but somehow those questions fall on deaf ears. Instead, you get your referrals to surgery, to oncology, to further tests. You get really upset. Maybe you cry. Maybe you get anxious. And the doctor hands you a prescription for Valium and walks out. Now, instead, imagine a physician who tells you that you have a positive biopsy, but then gives you space to ask your questions, that combines what Dan Somacy, a colleague of mine, calls a scientific spiritual practitioner, combines some of the scientific information that he or she needs to share with you, but with a compassionate spiritual approach that listens, is present to you, asks what your support systems are. Do you have any spiritual support systems or beliefs that might help you get through this? You know, receiving bad news is a horribly stressful thing. What helps you get through times like this? That empowers you to find hope even in the midst of this very difficult conversation. Well, recently in Italy at a conference that was sponsored by the Fetzer Institute, we acted out that scenario. Kathy DeAngelis, who's the former editor of the Journal American Medical Association, played the cold doctor. I took the easy role and played the warm doctor. You, 500 people in the audience from all over the world, only two said they had an experience of a warm clinician. Everyone else, either in the group when we polled them or afterwards, came up and said, that sounds like the nurse I met in the ER. That sounds like, unfortunately, the doctor I have. This is the reality of what's happening right now in healthcare. People are rushed. They're being pushed through. They're not, they don't have, and it's not that these care professionals are bad people. They don't have the time to do the things we've just heard from my colleagues, which is to be present, to empower people, to help focus on health, even in the midst of disease. As the Surgeon General says, to fight for health rather than to fight against disease all the time. They don't have the time for that. And so our institute, which got started 10 years ago, but this is work that I've been doing for about 20 years, is about trying to create a field that might just change healthcare. And philanthropy has been essential to this happening. And I just want to acknowledge some of our major funders. The Templeton Foundation clearly from the very beginning helped fund this and helped fund the beginning of the institute, which, mind you, was the first chartered institute by a university, George Washington University, which is a secular school, and some of these other funders. And it's really our work, as was already said before, could not have happened without the generosity of the funders. We have applied for government grants. We have gotten an NIH grant before and other government grants, but always the initial funding came out of philanthropy. So also, I think, when I say giving possibility to make a difference, these funders take a chance on something that's not mainstream. When I first started a course on spirituality and health in 1992, my dean called me in. I had been an NIH researcher in biochemistry. He said, "You are crazy. You are crazy to be doing this. You're going to ruin your career. Why are you going down this path?" And a lot of foundations looked at spirituality and said, "What is this? Is this, you know?" And so to take a chance on something that's a little different out of the mainstream, I think, makes a huge difference. I want to put a definition up that was developed by National Consensus on spirituality, because that is often the stumbling block in starting conversations around spirituality and health. And just out of curiosity, how many of you have funded projects related to spirituality and health? Wonderful. What a great audience. Often, it's the question about what is spirituality. Some people are nervous that it's only about religion. Other people are nervous that it's only about New Age. It's kind of the sort of the extremes. You know, it's about all of that. But it's important from the patient's perspective and me as a clinician to ask a question in a way that opens the door for that person to answer whatever is really important to them. A question about religious affiliation does not necessarily get to this. Even a question about how often you meditate doesn't necessarily get to this. So it's an aspect of all of us that refers to the way that we seek and express meaning and purpose. But it's not just that. It's also how we find connection. People need to be connected in some way, and it's usually connection outside of themselves. It can be the moment, the self, others, nature, or the significant or sacred. Now, this was done at a consensus conference of people with many different beliefs and not. There were doctors, nurses, all the healthcare professionals, all different backgrounds and cultures, as well as clergy and other spiritual directors and chaplains. So the sacred encompasses religion, but also other ways that people might understand that. Now, there's been a lot of data here in this area, and if you're interested, I can always send you the slides. By the way, I'm not going to go through everything, but just to highlight some of these, quality of life is incredibly impacted by spirituality. The will to live. We did an HIV-funded study on patients with HIV/AIDS, and those patients that had a strong spirituality tended to do better. They tended to have a stronger will to live and tend to do better. Better stress management, and you've heard already about stress-associated markers, spiritual practices will affect those markers as well. There's a lot of data in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, big word, but basically emotions, imagery, words, prayers, relationships, all of these can impact and promote healing. And if we look at traditional cultures, believing that the healing journey is not one of just mechanical repair, and that's what a disease focus is, but it's about relatedness, restoring harmony, peace. That is what a spirituality and health approach does. Now, these are just a list of some spiritual practices, if you will, what are now, we've developed guidelines on how to, we've medicalized spirituality a little bit in order to make it more accessible and make it more part of a routine part of care. But meditation, mindfulness, gratitude practices, forgiveness, reconciliation, meaning-oriented therapy, Bill Breitbart's work at Sloan Kettering, dignity therapy, the spiritual components of yoga, tai chi, etc., community, faith-based, and other types of communities as well. All of these are practices for which there's data that shows positive impact. And so what would be the potential clinical impact if we can have a fully integrated spirituality and health system, better stress management, health outcomes, decreased medical error? Healthcare professionals that practice some sort of mindfulness or prayer or attention to the moment are have better concentration and are less likely to make errors. So all of these things, decreased utilization of unnecessary healthcare resources, patients that have relationships that have their spiritual distress addressed, and now we have diagnoses around that, tend to use, if it's attended by their primary care doctor, tend not to go to the ER, the urgent care, etc., because they have all their needs met in that one visit. I've talked about this already just briefly, our background. 1992 was the first course. We developed a spiritual history tool that's now widely implemented and being in this country, but also being translated in other countries. 2001, we were chartered by GW as the first institute, and now there are many other institutes and centers around the country and in Canada, in Australia. We've got national guidelines in education. We've made a tremendous impact in education in three schools in 1992. In our 2004 study, the majority of medical schools teaching spirituality and health education. I've already talked about some of this. And what I want to close with is what we're trying to do now is what we call the Whole Person Integrated Clinic. And why am I saying integrated as my colleagues do? Because it's not something kind of on the side, but really to have a regular practice of clinic that's interdisciplinary, including chaplains, art therapists, CAM practitioners. It's focused on everything that my colleagues have said. Healing, stress management, caring for the caregiver. We would include a beginning and a closing ritual for the caregivers involved to remind them of their call to serve. Patient view in all dimensions, love, compassion being central. I mentioned the wellness initiative. And just to highlight, the first textbook in spirituality and health just came out through Oxford University Press. There's flyers back there. There's a UK editor, myself, who's a chaplain, myself from the US, and a public health person from Australia. Very diverse, very different contributions, et cetera, and then making healthcare whole that's now being used in certain policy circles. And I want to close with some work I've done with Fetzer, and this is our vision, and I would guess that my colleagues would agree with this. We are bold enough to say that we want a healthcare system that is spiritual, even awe-inspiring. A healthcare system that will transform the hearts of those who give, receive, teach, and learn care, the culture of care, and the language of care. A system that will be other-regarding, altruism, moving towards justice by encouraging practitioners to work as a team to deliver service that's grounded in benevolence and altruism. A system that encourages self-compassion for the healthcare professionals and self-care, and that says to the practitioner, you don't have to take it all yourself. A system that strives for equity, removing barriers due to finance, culture, and individual status. We call for a health system that provides caregivers, professional and family caregivers, and care receivers the opportunity to realize their full selves, what you heard about human potential, physically, emotionally, socially, and spiritually, that emphasizes health and healing and that honors the health of the community. We seek a system that promotes compassionate care, respects the dignity of those who give and receive care, and promotes love and forgiveness through relationship-centered care. This is our vision. The president of the university is so excited about this. He's going to be hosting a briefing on the clinic that we hopefully will be able to put into practice. So thank you very much for your attention.
Please join me in thanking the panelists for their time today. I hope you have found it informative.